From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a decision state leaders all over the country have to make about health care now that the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act. The law calls for states to expand their Medicaid coverage, but the court said the federal government can't punish them by pulling their current funding if they decide not to. And right now, six governors have said they won't be expanding. Here in Utah, the mostly conservative leadership has been opposed to the health care law all along, but they've decided to wait before they make any decisions. Expanding Medicaid in Utah would mean tens of thousands more people in the system, and some lawmakers are wondering if the state can afford it. Others say with growing health care costs, Utah can't afford not to. Today in the program, we're exploring the options for states, talking about the political and human dimensions of providing health care for those in need. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Health Care Act late last month, it gave states the ability to choose for themselves whether to expand their Medicaid programs. And for some governors, it was an easy call. Six so far have said, no, we're not expanding. But Utah's leaders, who have been opposed to the law, have decided to wait before they make any decisions. Expanding Medicaid in Utah could mean tens of thousands more people in the system, and some lawmakers are wondering if the state can afford it. Others say with growing health care costs, Utah cannot afford not to. So today in the program, we're exploring the options for states. We'll work through the complicated Medicaid system, discuss the opportunities and options in a complex system. We'll talk about also the political and human dimensions of this story. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Terry Gilday is with us here in the studios. He's KUER's news director. And Terry, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug, for having us.
Let me introduce KUER's Andrea Smartin. She's with us. And Andrea, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I should say that the news department, just today, in fact, they have embarked on a four-part series that looks at Utah's decisions. And we'll put links, by the way, to all the stories on our website as well, of course. But Terry, I wanted to start with that, with your decision to take on the issue. Break it down, if you would, for us, the story as you approached it in the newsroom, what you were trying to accomplish and what you wanted to learn.
We've been talking about this as a newsroom since April. We got together and saw this coming down the pipeline. And this is before, of course, the Supreme Court decided ruled on the Affordable Care Act. But one of the facets of that Supreme Court decision is that Utah was among 27 states challenging the part of the law at the time mandated states to expand their Medicaid programs so a larger group of the uninsured population could be covered by insurance. So we saw this coming down the pipeline and we thought this is an important series for us to get a local perspective on, understand where Utah lawmakers are coming from. And we were working on the series and we decided probably around mid-May, to wait until the Supreme Court made their ruling. And I'm glad we did, because I don't think anybody realized could predict that ruling would come out. And that is that states have the option now to expand or not. In other words, Chief Justice John Roberts, in his majority opinion, said that states would not be penalized if they decide not to expand their Medicaid programs. Right. And really, that put a whole new, fresh perspective on our series. Now we're in kind of a holding pattern, and the state of Utah, Utah lawmakers, Governor Gary Herbert are trying to decide if this is the thing for Utah to do or not.
You know, Andrea, it was a kind of a knee-jerk reaction for some, you know, conservative states. Some governors said, no, we're not doing it. Mm-hmm. Utah's very conservative, completely red, has been for a long time. But it seems to me that it wasn't a knee-jerk reaction for them. I mean, they're against it, as I mentioned in the introduction, but they're really sort of thinking it through.
Yeah, you know, something I found interesting is people from all sides of the aisle, from different perspectives, everyone seems happy with this decision to wait, yeah, to take in more information. And there really is a lot still to learn and to analyze, I think, is what lawmakers are finding. And they have a lot of questions, yeah, still remaining for the federal government about what the options are for Utah. Is it black and white? They're not sure if, you know, is it a decision whether to expand Medicaid or whether not to? That's what it looks like right now on, yeah, the surface. But lawmakers are wondering, is it possible to do a partial expansion, right, or do some alternative program, a waiver program or a block grant program where Utah could get these funds and then use them, have more control over how they're used. A number of lawmakers are pushing for that kind of scenario. So there's a lot of questions that still remain, and I think we're still taking in the information. There's also a shifting political scene here where we don't know who's going to be in office come November.
Right.
So that is that's something that also I think lawmakers are waiting on to see what the playing field is going to look like.
And we'll talk about this more in depth as we go along, but it doesn't seem like they're getting a lot of answers, at least not yet, from the federal government about what their options might be.
Exactly. I think Terry can talk about some of the efforts he's made to try to get some answers.
Yeah, we as a newsroom, actually, I spent a few phone calls, a few emails trying to get a hold of someone from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Kathleen Sebelius is the Secretary of HHS. And really what the Roberts decision does is it opens up this anomaly in the law. Now that states won't be penalized if they do expand or not, could they do a partial expansion, as Andrea said? And the Department of Health and Human Services hasn't said yes, but they haven't said no. And they told me via emails and on the phone, hey, we can't go on the record and tell you whether there's going to be a partial expansion or not. My sense is that the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't want to put a reason out there for states like Utah and others not to expand, that they want to make sure that they want to work with states. They want to make sure that states expand their programs so they can provide coverage to a group of the population that if there is no expansion, will not have coverage.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back to that as we go along. But I guess I wanted to be as basic as we possibly can be, because I think that in some ways what the series gets at, part of it, is what is Medicaid? Who has access to it? What's it about? And I guess, Terry, you're finding that there are some misconceptions out there.
Quite a few. But let me start off, Doug, by talking about the differences between Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah. I think when they name these programs, they made them so close together in the way that they sound that they often get confused. Medicare is a federal program that is designed to meet the health care needs of senior citizens around the country. We know that it's federally funded. States really don't have a whole lot of, at this point, involvement in Medicare. Medicaid was established as a federal-state partnership to put together a health care safety net. In other words, have some place where folks who have no access to healthcare services and who have living basically in a real sense of poverty, that they have some place to go for basic healthcare services, in some cases primary care services, in a lot of cases catastrophic care services. That was the original intention of the program. It's grown to cover a lot of other healthcare needs that have been a bit of an anomaly for a long period of time. Folks who are adults and who are long-term disabled need the program. Elderly folks who are in nursing homes and can't afford nursing home care use Medicaid for that program in that sense of the program as well. Yeah. So it's come to metamorphosize and cover a larger group of people than perhaps it was originally intended.
So are you getting some sense from critics or just observers in general that it's spilled over, that it's sort of outlived its intent, that it's – and people are abusing it, or it's not understood, or it's sort of lost its way in some ways?
Well, it's definitely such a – I mean, the Affordable Care Act itself – I mean, we don't refer to the Affordable Care Act in the series as Obamacare, which I think is – it started off as sort of a politically loaded term. The Obama administration has embraced it now. They've sort of owned it. But that sort of, for me, showcases how politically charged this whole discussion is. And so what we wanted to do partially in the series is break into some of those stereotypes and go out on the street as we do in Whitney's story. If you heard it this morning, it's also on our website, kwer.org now. But we actually had Whitney Evans, our reporter, go out on the street and ask individuals what their perceptions of the program are. And then we found some individuals that sort of play off of those perceptions, and we – hopefully try to break down some stereotypes and give people an idea of who these individuals are who are benefiting from the program. I don't think anybody's ever been proud to be on Medicaid. There's a lot of stigma attached to it, but there are individuals who have used it for what it's intended to be, a safety net to help them get back on their feet financially and be able to afford some kind of private health care insurance.
But let's talk about one of the people in Whitney's story, this Arthur Morris, 18-year-old, born with this hole in his heart, has open heart surgery when he's an infant. He has these a rare disorder which affects his motor skills. It affects his speech. He cannot work.
Yeah,
really. And he's on Medicaid. Now, this is a permanent situation for him. This is not a temporary safety net situation for him. I mean, is this a sort of a common use of Medicaid dollars?
It is a common use, and you know, that kind of adult disabled population, I think, is a population that is, for you and me and the rest of us who are fortunate enough not to have those kinds of situations in our lives, they're sort of easy to forget about. But they're in a situation where the Morris family has to go out, has to find 24-hour care for their son. It's care that will be indefinite, but private insurance companies have not filled the gap to offer that kind of coverage.
And that's the point, right?
So where does the person go? The private market has not responded to the need for that. They don't see a chance to potentially make a profit off of that. You know, not good or bad, it just is. And so someone has to find a way to come up with that care. And so Medicaid, over the years, has filled those, tried to fill those voids for those individuals who are in a precarious situation that the private market has not fulfilled.
One of the things that, Andrew, did you have something?
Well, I just wanted to say that as we've looked at the people that Medicaid does cover, we've also looked at who it doesn't cover, and there's some gaps there, and that's one of Terry's stories that's coming up this week, looking at that gap, including adults without children. If they're not disabled, no matter how poor they are, they could be homeless and potentially still not qualify for Medicaid. So there are still gaps in the population that remain uninsured.
Yeah, I actually want to take some time with that story. So let's hold off on that for just a few moments because I want to get past these sort of basic concepts. Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Jason Cook is with us. He's a Medicaid Research and Policy Director for the Utah Health Policy Project. It's a health policy research and advocacy group. Before coming to Utah, Jason Cook served as Medicaid and SCHIP director for Texas, splits his time actually between the two states. He's joining us today from a studio in Austin. And Jason Cook, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So I guess where we are in the conversation right now is the question of the intent, the original intent of Medicaid, which, as we've been talking about, seems to have expanded maybe beyond its scope, maybe not. Where is Medicaid now in terms of how far afield is it from its original intent, and what role is it playing right now, do you think?
Well, I think original intent is important, but it's also important to recognize that these kinds of programs and these federal laws and rules have to kind of morph with the times, and they have to keep up with the developing insurance picture in the country. Originally, the program was established particularly around pregnant women with small children, people who were receiving cash assistance, and this is where some of the stigma that Terry was talking about earlier comes from, because historically we've associated Medicaid with welfare, with cash welfare.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, when welfare reform was implemented, there was a deliberate effort to make a separation so that we could start thinking about Medicaid as a healthcare program and not be confused by some kind of association with cash assistance. So over the years, as Terry said, the program has been expanded by Congress to include additional populations who were, again, whose needs were not being met by the private insurance market. So the program has expanded, but it's expanded in reaction to the marketplace. So it really has been a market-driven decision, if you will, to provide coverage to more of these people who couldn't find it in the private market.
So it's been a reaction to some of the gaps, some of the problems with healthcare.
That's right.
Which raises the question of what effect do you think, Jason Cook, the Affordable Care Act now, which has been, of course, upheld by the Supreme Court, what effect is that going to have on Medicaid? Will it – do you have a sense that it may shrink now, go back to some parts of its original intent because there would be access, or at least intending to be access for people?
Well, I don't think that the scope of the program is necessarily going to change. I think the program will still be needed to cover the same groups of people. What is going to be different is that you're going to see changes in individual family situations. For example, we know about a family that had private insurance. Their daughter had a condition that affected her heart and her immune system. That family exhausted the lifetime cap by the time that child was nine, the lifetime cap that their private insurer imposed. So the response was, naturally, we need to take care of our daughter. We enroll her in Medicaid.
Yeah.
So Medicaid was there to take care of all of those health care needs that the private insurance market wouldn't take care of because the child had met the lifetime cap. So what the mandate in the ACA means, the Affordable Care Act means, is that insurance companies, because they're not going to have more people insured, they're going to be able to spread their risk across a larger population, and they're not going to need lifetime caps. They're not going to need to impose exclusions for pre-existing conditions and all those things that limited their financial exposure. So now Medicaid can go back to taking care of folks who can't afford private insurance. So this family in particular, if the ACA had been in place, this family would have stayed on private insurance. Medicaid wouldn't have picked up that difference. And so those costs would have been saved to the Medicaid program. So I think there will be some savings, but I don't think that what we're talking about is Medicaid suddenly goes back to the way it was originally conceived in 1965. That's not the world we live in anymore.
Yeah. But there's – I guess the basic point is there's still absolutely a need to expand it for sure.
There's clearly a population that currently isn't covered by Medicaid that is not going to be able to afford the private insurance even with the subsidies. And those are the people that are the subject of the expansion. How many people as you said earlier, the leadership of Utah is taking a very deliberate, in my view, a very wise approach to this. They're trying to figure out, well, what are the numbers? We can talk philosophy all we want, but the reality is when it comes down to it, we need to make a decision based on what the numbers look like. So we don't really know exactly how many people we're talking about, but we do know the groups of people that would be subject to the expansion. We're talking about adults without any kids with a family income of between, say, $11,000 and $15,000 a year. We're talking about adults with kids with income between $9,500 and $25,000 a year. And we're talking about kids between the ages of 6 and 18 with family income of $19,000 to $25,000. So these are people who are basically living from paycheck to paycheck. And they're not they're looking at paying the rent. They're looking at paying for clothes, for food, making sure their kids have what they need for school. And if they could, a lot of these families, I think as Terry suggested, a lot of these families would just as soon pay for their own insurance. That'd be their preference. But the reality is they can't. So these are the folks who we're talking about as part of the expansion population.
Terry, wanted to Andrew was mentioning the gaps in coverage. That's something that you've been looking at, and I wanted to talk to you about that. I guess there's this question of whether Medicaid is really sufficient as it stands, let alone, you know, I mean, let alone expanding it, whether or not it's sufficient the way it stands now.
Yeah. And over the years, there have been different programs, even in Utah, where they've tried to cover more people by spending less money. And in some cases, there have been gaps in services. In the story that I report on, which will be part three of the series, it'll air on Wednesday morning. I spend part of the story talking about the Primary Care Network, or PCN, which came to life in Utah around 2002. Governor Mike Leavitt was governor then and helped put the program in place. He later went on to be Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Bush administration. But basically what Primary Care Network did is it gave folks who were enrolled in the it raised the income eligibility slightly to about 150% of the poverty level, if I'm correct. And but it didn't cover any kind of hospital visits or any kind of care. It did for a little while. I was talking with Judy Hillman from the Utah Health Policy Project, and Jason helped us with this as well, kind of giving us a background on PCN. There was some hospital coverage for a little while, but that ran out. And so I profile an individual in my piece, Carlene Kidman, who lives in Layton. She was on PCN, and she had some catastrophic health problems, and PCN wouldn't cover them. She got pneumonia twice. Anybody who's had pneumonia and who knows what that's like, that's a it requires in some cases, a hospital stay, which is what it required for Carlene, but she didn't have the money to pay out of pocket for that. She injured her knee in a particular accident, was told she needed to see a specialist and potentially have surgery, and PCN wouldn't cover any of that. And she was looking at a bill of $2,000 to $5,000 out of pocket to see a specialist and potentially have surgery done. So what PCN did is it took care of primary care visits, several doctor's visits, I think 4 prescriptions a month. But when a person needed any kind of long-term care or catastrophic care, the program didn't cover that at all. So you still have folks going to the emergency room, still have folks that are not getting the health care that they need for particular issues.
Well, and she runs into this kind of catch-22 situation, Carlene Kidman does. I mean, her employer says that they'll give her this modest raise, but then that puts her over the eligibility in terms of her income.
And people run into this a lot. That's how the financial box that you have to be in to be on a Medicaid program really limits you. And Dan Bomas spends a lot of time focusing on that in his story. But what happened to Carlene is she went to her employer and said, look, I need private health insurance. She works for a nonprofit in Layton that deals with kids who are in juvenile court. It's an important job, but it's nonprofit. They don't have a whole lot of money. So they looked into what it would cost for private and health insurance and what she would have to pay out of pocket for that premium every month, and it was more than half of her monthly income. Yeah. And so she couldn't afford that. So her nonprofit said, well, we'll give you a raise so you can make, up to this amount of money per year. But that knocked her out of the eligibility. So she gets the raise. She has extra money every month, but she doesn't have PCN anymore, and she doesn't have near enough money to buy private and health insurance. So Carlene has been uninsured since 2007. When the Affordable Care Act kicks in, if her income level stays at what it is now, she'll be just off of the edge of the eligibility for the Medicaid expansion, but she'll be able to get what are called, as Jason mentioned, the premium subsidies. The federal government's going to help people buy private health insurance, and Carlene, because of where she is and her income level, will be able to afford it that way. But imagine being in a situation where your boss says, hey, I want to give you a raise for all the great work you've been doing, and you have to tell that boss, I can't take your raise because my health care will disappear if I take it. And that's the situation that a lot of people are in.
Jason Cook, talk about that. Dan Bomas mentions it, as Terry mentioned in his piece. I think it's called spending down. You see a lot of that in the system?
Yeah, there's a fair amount of this where families don't qualify for Medicaid because of their income, but they end up spending so much out of pocket for the medical costs that they finally get to the point where they actually qualify for Medicaid. And I think that raises the question. It's an unfortunate and a fortunate aspect of Medicaid. It's good that it's there for those families, that they've got that option. It's unfortunate to make a family basically spend everything they've got in order to get health care. And what we're facing in the absence of a Medicaid expansion in Utah and in other states is the continuation of this dynamic that Terry was talking about, where you've got families who are currently covered by Medicaid, and they look at opportunities to move into other jobs, to move to a different community and get a different job, to basically improve their quality of life for themselves and their families. But the upshot of that is they're going to fall into this basically a donut hole. We talk about donut hole in Medicare all the time about the prescription drugs, but in this case it's a Medicaid donut hole where they get to the edge of their Medicaid benefits, they get a better job, and suddenly there's nothing. They can't get a premium subsidy because they don't qualify for that. Medicaid hasn't expanded, so they can't continue their Medicaid, and they're basically uncovered. And then the question is, who's going to provide their health care? And I think this is, to go back to something you said in the introduction, Doug, I think there is a penalty to not expanding Medicaid in Utah and in the other states. This is one of the penalties for the families. They face this prospect of, I can't improve my family's lot because I'll lose health insurance. The other penalty is millions and millions of dollars that Utahns have paid in federal taxes that don't come back to Utah in the form of a very favorable match rate. In other words, the federal government putting up 100% for the first 3 years of the cost of the expansion, and eventually it scales back to 90%. But where else can you get a deal like this where you spend a dollar and somebody else chips in $9? So there is a penalty, an implicit penalty, in not expanding Medicaid.
I think you've said, Jason Cook, that some of these income regulations, for example, are kind of intentional obstacles discouraging people from getting access to the Medicaid program. Do you want to talk about that?
There have been policies that states have implemented for example, checking for assets. And now, of course, we don't want somebody coming into the Medicaid program if they're living in a beautiful mansion, they have five boats, and all the horror stories that you hear that are anecdotal, but they don't happen very often. But the reality is those regulations about assets make it very difficult for people to maintain a car or a couple of cars if both adults work to get to work. So they basically discourage people from exactly what we're trying to get them to do, which is essentially graduating from Medicaid. So states have implemented those kinds of regulations to try to keep the Medicaid rolls low, the enrollment low. And from our perspective, this should be a pretty straightforward proposition. Either you qualify for Medicaid or you don't, and let's make a decision as public policy people, as leaders, as citizens, that Medicaid is something that is a value, provides a value to our society by making sure these people have health care and can work and go to school and learn, or not. If we decide not to, that's a different decision. But let's not try to kind of keep people out of the program by these sort of tricks of the regulations. All we're doing is hurting the public dialogue and the body politic by playing those kinds of games.
Terry, how are the people on the ground in the state reacting to the idea that these are intentional obstacles to keep people from the system? It's one of the things that you sort of take on in the series.
Yeah, we do. Dan Bomas, in his story, which will air tomorrow morning, he talks with folks at the Department of Workforce Services about the asset test and other obstacles. And, you know, while I think there's certainly an argument to be made that these obstacles are there to sort of keep people off the program or discourage them from getting on the program, DWS, the folks he talked to there, says that, you know, they're trying to sort of work within a system and keep a sense of checks and balances. It's not a perfect system by any stretch of the imagination, but there are obstacles there. There's a lot of stigmatism about being on this program. Jason and I have had plenty of discussions. We interviewed him for this series about just how difficult that stigma can be. You've got the obstacles of letting everybody know what's going on in your life as far as your income and those kinds of things. But then in more rural areas of Utah, you know, what if someone sees you sitting in a section of the waiting room at the doctor's office for Medicaid patients? What if someone sees you in a line for Medicaid patients? You have to open up all these kinds of things about your personal life, which can be, for lack of a better term, humiliating for some folks. Be difficult.
Terry Gilday is with us, KUER's news director. Andrea Smarden, also with us, reporter for KUER. Jason Cook, Medicaid research and policy director for the Utah Health Policy Project. The series from KUER's news department on the future of Medicaid in Utah got underway this morning. It runs through Thursday during Morning Edition. All the series, of course, will be available on our website, KUER.org. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Medicaid, about the decision that Utah's lawmakers, as well as other states, are having to make now that the Supreme Court has ruled on the health care law. KUER's news department has just begun a series, started today, that looks at the future of Medicaid in Utah in particular, but also sort of gets at the questions that, as we said, state lawmakers are working through. It started this morning, runs through Thursday during Morning Edition. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. KUER's news director, Terry Gilday, is joining us in the studio here along with Andrea Smarden. We also have Jason Cook, Medicaid Research and Policy Director for the Utah Health Policy Project. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Carol, who writes from Saratoga Springs. One consideration about Medicaid in Utah, she writes, is that this state has a much higher birth rate than elsewhere in the nation. How will they deal with that? Will that mean more people in Utah added than in other states? Let me put that to Terry. Is this something you deal with in the series? Do you want to say something about that, or should I put that to Jason?
Well, I'll hand it to Jason in a second. It is a large population of the Medicaid program in Utah. But as Jason said earlier in the show, one of the original intentions of Medicaid was to make sure that families brought healthy babies into the world, and that moms had the prenatal care they needed, and that infants had the care they needed in the hospital. And it's been, I think, a vital part of the program, not just in Utah, but in the rest of the country. And I think because of the higher birth rate, perhaps in Utah, it's become a larger part of the program. But that, I believe that was one of the original intents of the program.
Jason Cook, what do you think?
That was one of the original intents of the program. And I think we have to ask ourselves, independent of the numbers, which, again, we don't know the numbers yet. I think the state officials are still trying to put pen to paper on that. But we have to ask ourselves whether we want these kids to have a healthy start in life. And if we're not covering those kids and we're not covering their mothers during the pregnancy, leading up to the pregnancy and the immediate period after the pregnancy, then we run the risk of higher rates of premature birth, higher rates of problems at birth and after birth. And from a financial standpoint, we'll all end up spending more to take care of those problems than we would have if we had made sure that those mothers and those kids were taken care of from the start.
Carol, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Andrea Smartin, talk a little bit about just when we're talking about costs, which mm-hmm. this is the clincher for a lot of state lawmakers. What are we talking about that in terms of money here?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because I think, we've been talking about the people affected. We've been talking about those who are on Medicaid or who may qualify for Medicaid if we expand it. But I think this, and partly why we did this series, is that this decision affects all of us, even if you don't care about who's on Medicaid or what happens to those people who could enroll. So there's state taxes to consider. Medicaid is a portion of our general fund.
Yeah.
And that's also the fund that pays for education and higher education and corrections. So the big concern for lawmakers is, this is going to keep eating into those same resources, right? Medicaid, as it continues to grow, takes from that same general fund. So that's a major concern. And they're concerned about expanding Medicaid. But I think it's worth pointing out that an even greater cost to the state, there is currently 30% of people who are eligible for Medicaid are not enrolled. And Peter Cook can correct me if I'm wrong on that. So all of those people could potentially enroll in Medicaid once the individual mandate goes into effect in 2014.
Yeah.
So that is actually going to be an even greater cost to the state than an expansion if all those people who currently qualify for Medicaid actually decide to sign up. And there will be motivation to sign up when there's an individual mandate and we're all supposed to have health insurance. Medicaid might be their only option.
Yeah.
So that's another cost that the lawmakers looking at. So that decision essentially has already been made. If the Affordable Care Act is upheld, we're already committing to these costs, which the State Department of Health has estimated over the next 10-year period could cost the state more than $900 million.
I think you called Jason Cook Peter Cook.
I'm sorry. I meant to say Peter.
Not running for governor.
I was going to say that. I completely understand why you would have.
Peter Cook, yes.
But Jason, you want to does that comport with what you're thinking about in terms of numbers?
Andrew's right. Those are the numbers that have been floated out there initially by the health department. But I think it's important to remember that, first of all, the health department itself is now going back and reworking those estimates. Some of their baseline numbers they weren't comfortable with, the numbers that they started with as they built the estimate that Andrea was referring to. But the other issue is, in terms of this population that is currently eligible, not enrolled for Medicaid, and they might suddenly all come in through the door, people refer to it as the woodwork effect, that these people are suddenly going to appear in the DWS process and want on Medicaid. The reality is that there are substantial numbers of these people, first of all, who are not subject to the penalty because their income is too low. We're talking about the poorest of the poor in Utah who are now eligible but not enrolled. There's also the issue of the cost of those who do enroll, and there are some offsetting costs that we have to keep in mind. First of all, I'm sorry, offsetting savings we have to keep in mind. First of all, everybody in Utah who pays private insurance premiums to their employer or directly saves money every time somebody who's not insured gets insurance. That's because if somebody walks in to get treatment and they don't have insurance, the provider who's giving the treatment turns around and says to the insurance company, I can't afford to do this for free. You're going to have to pay me more so I can treat these uninsured people. The insurance company then turns around and says, well, we can't afford to give you more unless we take more from the people who are paying premiums. So if that uninsured person suddenly has coverage and they walk into the doctor's office or the hospital, you stop that dynamic of growing private insurance premiums. And then finally, there are going to be savings in the state budget, particularly in the areas of mental health services on which the state spends state dollars, criminal justice system. There's a lot of medical care that's provided through the criminal justice system, and there'll be savings there as a result of the Medicaid expansion. So I would just encourage people who are listening to the program and to the series that KUR is putting on to keep their powder dry on the numbers, because the numbers are going to change. And I think there are a lot of people with good intentions and very smart people working to make sure the state gets the right numbers to make this decision.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Leilani is with us in West Valley. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Let me first say I love your show. You have a really easy voice to listen to.
Good. Good. Thanks. Go ahead.
And I always love the topics as well. I have a question, which is, who is expected to pay for all of this? Because it's not only going to add services, from what I understand, but it's going to also add amounts of people that are going to be covered by medical care or Medicaid. And I just can't understand where all this money is going to come from, except for the middle class, which I happen to be a part of. Most of us are, I guess.
Yeah. Andrea, I guess that's the question lawmakers are asking themselves,
right,
as well.
Right. And a lot of them, I think Senator Stuart Adams says, nobody's figured out how to pay for this, and we're making promises to the public. And there's some lawmakers have been sort of throwing out this rhetoric like, we don't even know if the federal government can handle this. They're making this promise that they're going to, you know, pay for this 100%, this expansion for the first few years, and then pay for up to 90% of it 10 years down the road. And, you know, there's a question of whether the federal government would default or uphold those promises, and would the state be left holding the bag? And that's all conjecture, but that's the rhetoric that's been going around in the, you know, when the state health reform task force meets. These are some of the questions that are being raised.
Jason Cook, somebody asks you the question, who pays for this? How do you respond?
Well, I think that it's clear that there are going to be costs in terms of the additional health care. There are costs in terms of the additional people who are going to be brought into the Medicaid program. But when we talk about costs, again, it's a bigger picture than just what is going out in the way of expenditures. As I mentioned earlier, there are significant savings to be had not only from mental health and criminal justice, but there are also—
I guess the crucial question is, do they offset the costs?
Well,
do you
and
think?
I think that's what the state is wrestling with now and trying to look at these numbers, because
that's what the state's wrestling with. But what do you think? Do you think there is an answer there yet?
Having seen the numbers of what the state spends on mental health and what it spends on criminal justice, there's going to be a significant offset to the costs. What that's going to be exactly, what the dollar amount is, that's what the numbers crunchers are figuring out.
Yeah.
But if you look at the all of the analysis that was done leading up to the enactment of this Affordable Care Act, the Congressional Budget Office, the people who crunch the numbers at the federal level, looked at all of these questions, and they have suggested there are actually going to be savings in the long run as a result of covering these folks. So are we going to spend some more money marginally, we may spend some more money marginally. Is it worth it in terms of the long run by making sure that these people are healthy and they're getting good care at the right time in the right place and they're getting the right care? Absolutely.
There's a question that comes up whether or not the government really ought to even be in this role that is addressed in the series that KUER is producing. We're going to get to that when we get back from a break. Terry Gilday is with us, Andrea Smarden. We also have Jason Cook, Medicaid Research and Policy Director for the Utah Health Policy Project. Leilani, thanks very much for the call, by the way. We'll get to more when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Medicaid and the decision that Utah lawmakers and lawmakers around the country are making about their health care Medicaid system now that the Supreme Court has ruled on the health care law. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us in the studio is Stan Rasmussen. He's the Director of Public Affairs for the Sutherland Institute. It's a conservative public policy think tank based here in Salt Lake City. And Stan Rasmussen, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be here.
Well, I guess let's start with the basics. What is essentially wrong with the Medicaid system, with the system that's in place right now?
Well, first off, it's the federal government involved in health care. But also, I think because the federal government is involved, it has all the hallmarks of a federal government-involved program. It's questionably effective, it's not efficient, and it's very expensive.
So I guess what you've talked about is you believe that that the private sector needs to be the one that takes over. A proposal you're calling authentic charity care. And I wanted you to sort of give us a sense of that because I wanted to ask you some questions about
it. Sure. Thank you for that. A couple of years ago, actually three, we were in 2010 general session, and we worked prior to that to till the soil, as it were. But we were successful in passing the authentic charity care healthcare joint resolution. And what that does is, and it's not statute, it's a resolution, but it makes some very important points. Included among those are, it recognizes authentic charity care as a key component of state health care policy. It expresses support
for— But what is it?
What is authentic charity
care?
Yeah,
what is it?
It well, as outlined in the resolution, which is a fair capture of what we're talking about, it would create a health care commission that would effectively be a state chartering and oversight organization, and the state would not necessarily have to fund it, but it would need to be undertaken at the state level to encourage and promote additional authentic charity care clinics.
So it's a group of – but who is it, I guess? It's a group of people from the private sector that are concerned about people who don't have access to health care.
Correct.
And as opposed to a government bureaucracy or a government program or taxpayer money, they just step into a private free market and provide health care. That's the basic idea?
Yes, but to step into the private free market in the sense that it's already being done now. We have the Malia Free Clinic. We have the Shriners. We have a number of free clinics in the state. We would like to see that number expanded. And the people who come there to receive services receive them from volunteers. There are organizations that fund equipment and fund supplies, but in large measure, the professional attention is volunteer and donated work.
Right. What's the government's obligation?
With respect to that?
Well, here's the question. What's the government's obligation to any citizen related to health care? Your sense is the government has no basic obligation to see that a person is cared for.
Well, I think that's a fair characterization. We would say, you know, some would say, well, health care is a right, and we would take issue with that.
Yeah.
We do not think it's a right. We think it's a personal responsibility. And yet, as human beings, we have responsibilities to one another, and we think there are ways that health care has been provided in the past and could be now, largely through an authentic charity care methodology for those who are not able to afford it themselves.
So right now it's a kind of a concept, I suppose. It was a resolution which indicated that Utah lawmakers thought, oh, this is kind of a good idea. But how far away are you from implementing such a concept?
Good question. We have the resolution, and the legislature embraced it. And among the provisions in it is that the resolution would be sent to the governor and to the health department, Association of Counties, League of Cities and Towns, and Utah Medical Association. There's more work to be done, clearly. I think we've tilled the soil. We need to now plant some seeds and nurture that. But I think we're on record, and the legislature is too, that this is and needs to be an important part of health care policy and the manner by which people in the state of Utah receive health care.
So what are you making of the argument that we've been talking about, the idea of expanding? Clearly you're against it. I mean, you're against the concept in principle, I suppose, as well. But what do you figure is going to happen now in light of the Supreme Court ruling in terms of Medicaid in the
states? Short term, it'll be just what the state leaders have indicated. The governor and legislative leaders have said they're going to take a wait-and-see approach on this. That doesn't mean nothing is happening. There's a lot going on. And let me just make a sidebar comment here. Utah has some outstanding people working in the area of health care. The governor's staff, Norm Thurston, the people in Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel, Kathy DuPont, Mark Andrews, and others there. I think they are to be hugely thanked for their efforts, because as a result of the Supreme Court decision, since the PPACA was passed, and even now with the decision pending what may come in the future, those folks are dealing with we sometimes use the analogy of taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. I think these folks are like standing at the bottom of the spillway tubes at Lake Powell when they're letting it go full tilt. Just in terms of the amount of daily information and provisos and updates and, oh, by the ways, and not that, this, that they're having to deal with. And so a huge thanks to them, and they're helping us cope. But I think it's appropriate. In part, it's a political decision to wait and see what happens in the November election with not only the White House, but the disposition of the Congress, the two chambers of Congress. But I think
you're not expecting that to change, a repeal to actually hold up. Even if, let's say, Mr. Romney became president, and they took over the Senate, I mean, they wouldn't have a veto. They wouldn't. Do you think they'd be able to repeal it? Is that you're having hopes for that?
I would think there's that possibility. Yeah.
I would think you'd need a supermajority in the Senate.
You do need a supermajority.
Filibuster-proof 60.
And that seems to be the clincher. But I guess the question is, are you seeing that what are you recommending, for example? What are you saying that the governor should do? Andrea has been reporting, for example, and you mentioned Norman Thurston, who's been trying to get some indication from the federal government as to whether or not they would give something that's not just black and white, so, you know, if whether or not there would be a waiver or a partial expansion or there might be room for something else. What are you recommending? I mean, beyond your hopes that there would be a repeal that would stand up, what are you recommending in the practical terms?
Do not expand Medicare.
Do not.
I'm sorry, Medicaid.
Of course, yep.
Yeah, Medicaid. Yeah, do not.
Just and
well, yeah, there's a provision that states can consider that, and we have been public in our recommendation that the state not do that.
Right.
It's interesting to see. The governor has made some comments in a publication. I don't know how widely published it's been, but he's giving some thought to some possibilities. But Congressman Bishop, now in the last couple of days, has talked about something that would convert it back to the states and have block grant money there, which is something we would pay very close attention to, because there's some significant touch points with the healthcare compact that we worked earnestly to have passed in this last session. And if it's not inappropriate to take a minute on that, the healthcare compact,
sure, yeah,
like all compacts, would invite states to join, and to date there are 7 states. And when there's a critical mass, and that's not a specific number, but I mean, there's not a target number. It's just when there are enough states to have it make sense, those states would approach Congress to negotiate for a return of health care policy authority back to the states, as well as funds for the states to administer those programs under the purview or under the structure and framework of the negotiated agreement with Congress.
Right.
And so, block grants coming back to states and states having that discretion, that's the right way to do it.
So now with the ruling, how does that affect this compact?
Well, the Health System Reform Task Force of the state is identified a group to work as a working group, the Healthcare Compact Working Group, under the leadership of and direction of Senator Adams, who was the chief sponsor of the Healthcare Compact bill. We have met several times. There are a number of citizen participants as well as legislators, and we're taking a close look at the details that were outlined in that bill. And there was a sunset date put on it of July of 2014, within which some specific information and homework needs to be done and reported back to the legislature. And it's my belief that as those processes unfold, information will be acquired, and it will not be sunsetted, but will continue because it makes sense.
Andrew Smartin, let me come back to you. What do you think, as lawmakers now are trying to figure all of this out, whether or not they're going to get any room from the federal government, what are you expecting? Is it too early to say?
Yeah, I think it is too early to say. What it sounds like, Norm Thurston is the director of the healthcare reform implementation. Is that the correct title? For the state, and he says he expects this to be resolved in the legislative session, the upcoming legislative session, because it will have to be a decision that lawmakers will approve. And that's our opportunity to do it in the general session. The other thing that Norm Thurston said is that as lawmakers are looking at this decision, they need to look at the impact on the budget, and they also need to look at the impact on people. And of course, that's the hard thing to measure, or hard to quantify, right? And that's kind of what we're trying to do in our series here at the news department, is get into the stories of these people that are affected and see what we can find out. That is the hard part to measure, the human impact.
Yeah. Well, that's Andrea Smartin. She's a reporter for KUER. Terry Gilday, the news director for KUER. We should mention that their series got underway this morning. It runs through Thursday. Go to our website for the particulars, KUER.org. Terry, Andrea, thanks very much.
Thanks,
Doug. Thank you.
Let me thank Jason Cook, Medicaid Research and Policy Director for the Utah Policy Project. Jason, thanks to you.
Thank you, Doug.
And Stan Rasmussen, we'll have to have you back to talk more about this. Thanks very much for being with
us. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate being
here. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.